approach to standards and interoperability. I guess everybody have access to the wiki page, which is called Conference Call 204-0212. And Steve's presentation, the PowerPoint presentation, is linked there, right underneath the About the Speaker section. Does everybody have access to that? And of course, it's also available at the VNC2 machine, where the VNC and the view-only passwords are available from the same page. If anyone has problems, please say so now. Otherwise, we will start. Steve,
okay.
Over to you.
This is going to be a new experience for me, sort of talking in this internet-based way, so bear with me if I come across not as smooth as I might like. But anyway, what I was hoping to do is talk in a sort of a more of a dialogue way of just giving a little bit of our sort of top-down sort of approach to how we are doing our job, which has a lot to do, obviously, with standards and measurements. And unlike, I guess you had Leo Oberst last time, who was given a much more detailed, in-depth, technical sort of treatment of the semantics and ontologies, I'm going to try and give you a little bit more of our perspective on why we think a semantic approach plays directly into where we're headed and what we're doing and why it's relevant and why it's going to be the way to go in the future. So it's sort of more about the semantics and ontology technologies as compared to a tutorial on semantics and ontologies in any way. I'd be hard-pressed to give you guys a tutorial on that anyway. So I see, yeah, Peter, you've already advanced the slide to number two there, the outline. And so I want to just hopefully not bore you too much on a little bit of the NIST context of where we're coming from, how we're approaching our standards work, little observations on where we see standards evolving, and be interested in people's observations in reaction to that. Then sort of delve in a little bit more on what I feel are two principal drivers, a need for rigor, and a leverage. What I mean by leverage on slide number two there is leveraging of the rather labor-intensive practice of developing standards in the first place. And then I'll go into sort of some overviews of a couple of projects within my division, which sort of illustrate our approach to semantics. And I know that some of this is known to some of you who are listening, so you'll have to bear with me, and if you guys all get too bored, let me know, but some people may not be as familiar with some of these projects. So then at the very end, I just wanted to share a half a dozen slides or so, which came out of a study we did on sort of the components of systems integration, sort of what are the different aspects that need to be considered when systems are being integrated. And when we did this study, it was kind of a shocker to all of us, I think, really the wide range of issues that really need to be taken into account of, and which often many of them aren't even really considered when systems are being integrated. And, of course, we all pay the price for those down the road when something comes back and hits us. But I'll see what you think on that one at the end. So I'm going to switch on to the next page here, page slide three, which is eerily blank. Now, why is that? Oh, maybe it's an animation. Hold on here. Let me see. Let me go to...
Should I put you on full screen?
Yeah. Maybe we'll go to the... No, that's weird. Let me page up. Summary. Oh, wow. How do we get to the end already? All right, let's go. That's the very last slide.
is somebody else also on view and control mode on the VNC besides Steve and myself?
Well, let's see how it goes.
All right. Okay.
All right. So anyway, this is just a very high level slide that something like the director of NIST often uses, and it's just to remind people a little bit about what the heck is NIST, which used to be the National Bureau of Standards. We changed our name in 88, and half the world sort of then lost track of us because no one knew who the heck NIST was. But anyway, by far, the historical and the traditional role of NIST has been in sort of the physical metrology domain. Physical standards, and what you see at the top of this pyramid is the notion of basic units. There are 7 fundamental units, and everyone can now wow people at cocktail parties when you know all 7 fundamental units, but there they are, which underlie the whole physical world in terms of units, of measure. But basically, we serve as this country's what's called National Measurement Institute, which is the traceability pyramid there, so that all measurements in this country, ultimately, when people care, like when they're buying and selling goods or whatever, either through state services, which then refer back to national services, all trace back to measurements which we certify here in the NIST laboratories. So, in my own laboratory, which is the Manufacturing Engineering Laboratory, we're responsible for 2 of those units, the units of length and mass, the kilo and the meter. So indeed, the floor below my office, there's the meter, which is now just a bunch of laser apparatus. It's certain, you know, defined a certain number of wavelengths of light, etc. And the kilo is the last, another cocktail piece of information, last artifact standard. That's actually a lump of metal, which we don't actually have the world master. The French do that, and we, along with a lot of other countries, intercompare those things. The reason I'm going on at some length about this is because I believe that as much as the physical systems of measures have basically underlied our whole system of commerce, which is why we are part of the Department of Commerce, because we basically ensure there's a reliable and trusted system of weights and measures, which allows people then to buy and sell things because they can trust when I'm buying a barrel of oil that your barrel of oil is the same size as my barrel of oil kind of thing. My premise is that, as you see on the next page, that these days the information world is playing as large a role in terms of economic impact, in terms of commerce, as the physical world has in the past. In fact, of course, we all depend heavily upon huge numbers of information standards. This stack is just one I pulled from some of our work on the business-to-business kind of thing, but, and I even noticed that Leo had some of these in his slides as well. You know, and I didn't even get into the ones off the bottom there, all the network protocols and the bit level kinds of standards. You know, all the way down to which voltage levels are valid voltage levels on an Ethernet cable or something. So all of these things, of course, are, well, one way to think of it is the physical world has what are called descriptive standards. Okay, we are basically trying to measure a thing which is out there, which exists, whether or not we observe it, if you want to get a little philosophical at times. Information standards, on the other hand, are what are called normative standards. In other words, we are specifying, in typically a consensus way, how we should be, you know, encoding data or transmitting data and stuff. So it's all man-made, unlike the physical world, which is out there before we were around. The information world isn't. And so there is that big difference, but while there is that difference, the parallels are also there in the sense that what we need is a system of measures. We need a system of units for information. We need to, whoops, somebody just advanced us. Let me back up here. We need a system of units to measure information. and ultimately measure interoperability. And in the absence of that, we really can't say too much in any kind of a rigorous way about system reliability or predict system performance. Just like in the absence of measurements, you can't predict whether a bridge is going to fall down or not. And it's once you had that science base of modeling bridges and you had the measurement technology to actually make measurements of strength and hardness and everything else, could you start to say things in a statistically significant way about the way that bridge is going to behave. So we're far from that in the information world. We're still in what I would call the craft phase of software, where we can't design software anywhere near as in a quantitative way as we can design bridges. However, and my point is that I think a semantic and ontological approach to information, certainly at the symbolic level, at the content level, is clearly going to head us in that direction. All right, let me stop that little soapbox and go to the next slide. I can't even see which slide number I'm on each time. Let's see, this would be 3, is that right, or 4? Wait, I'm gonna have to bring this up in another screen so I can keep track of where I am, but...
So the last slide was 4, you're coming up on 5.
Okay, appreciate that. Anyway, let me just pause here just a moment. I'm going to bring up locally so I could just sort of see the slide count without having to fumble around each time.
Yeah, I'll prompt you on the site. You're moving on to slide number 5.
Okay.
A three-way approach to manufacturing.
All right.
Interoperability.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, by the way, did someone log into VNC with a control and view password? If you do, I'd appreciate if you just log back out and log in with AutoLock as the password, and that would be view only. That way we won't mess up Steve's navigation.
Okay, well, I'm back. Okay. All right, so now I just want to give you a quick view of our division. This is the Manufacturing Systems Integration Division, just so that you can get some context as to how the work I'm going to describe sort of fits into the overall picture. There are really three principal kinds of work we do. The one you see on the screen now, which has got the little yellow star of assistance to industry, it includes a variety of activities where we're doing things with typically industrial partners, which are fairly accessible and near-term payback kinds of activities. This would include things like conformance testing services or interoperability testing services. We have a variety of test beds with a variety of partners like the automotive industry or the Air Force, and work in conjunction with also people like the groups in Europe under Framework 6, or in fact we've just had an agreement with a Korean test bed called Corbett. Again, to sort of be sister nodes, if you like, for interoperability testing. So in this context, groups come forward and say, look, we've got this scenario. We really want to see if we can pass information using both web services and EBXML, let's say. This is something we did with the automotive guys. Can't we try and instrument this kind of thing and see what works and what doesn't work? So it's kind of putting all the standard stacks together and making measurements and diagnoses, if you like, to show what's working, what isn't working, and then advise. Some of the partners might be software vendors or middleware folks as to what's missing or what's going wrong. So that's all it's nearer term, a lot of work going on there, but it's stuff that people, our customers, American industry, can see some tangible results, and they come to get some help, and we can give them some help. Now, underlying that, however, is a whole bunch of research. Now, this is the kind of stuff that, honestly, I think a lot of you are probably much more interested in, and as am I guess, but this is much longer term. This is the kind of work that is not going to yield any quantifiable benefits anytime soon as far as companies saving money or being more, you know, competitive or something like that. But this is where most of our semantics work is really going on, where we are exploring a variety of notions. I won't go into great detail yet because I have some of this description later on in the talk. But here's where we're asking some very fundamental questions, and you see, for example, in the upper left part of this research testbed box, this little box called semantic equivalence metrics. And that was, in fact, we had a workshop last fall that Peter participated in, among others, and that was basically to ask the question, okay, look, when you're talking about interoperability, you're talking really about the transference of meaningful information, of meaning, from one system or location to another. That's what interoperability is all about, so that the system, the receiving system, can then manipulate that information and do something useful. Now, in fact, of course, generally, given that system A and system B are in different contexts in one way or another, you're not going to have semantic equality when this information is taken from one system and put into the context of another. But you sort of, as humans anyway, we sort of arrive at the conclusion, well, okay, when you're talking about a shipping date, you know, that's close enough to what I call the, you know, delivery time or something like that. Close enough that we can do business and we can, you know, carry on with our work. Well, as people, we make these, draw these conclusions all the time, of course. But what's being done is something much more subtle, which is how close is close enough? How do we know that your notion of a given concept is close enough to my notion of a concept? And how do we measure that? As people, we do this sort of semi-intuitively, but obviously if we ever hope to have computer systems do this, they're not so good at that part, so they need a measure. And we don't even know what the unit of measure of semantic distance is from one interpretation or one definition of a concept to another. So, you know, there are various approaches that people have tried on a sort of a non-fundamental approach. You know, you can just go and say, well, this word in WordNet is two hops away from that word in WordNet, so it's pretty close, as opposed to, you know, 20 hops. And obviously there's no underlying science there. That's just symptomatic. So we held a workshop trying to ask some questions as to what branches of mathematics or other disciplines could have some bearing on giving us insight onto how to approach even something like a semantic distance metric. Obviously, that's way out there in terms of it's not going to be increasing, you know, Cisco's bottom line anytime soon or something. But so that's kind of one small piece of the work we're doing there. In a more general sense, we are really trying to attack the issues of using formal ontologies in the context of standards development. And again, I'll speak more about that in just a little bit. In between those two, then, those two kind of areas, we have sort of a cross-pollination of both needs of what's coming up that industry needs and results and approaches and tools that are coming out of the research. So that works all pretty well. And then finally, hit the last animation button on this slide. A lot of this feeds directly into our work in the standards world. And the standards world is much broader than it used to be. About 10 years ago, I guess, most of our work really involved working with ISO and ANSI. And now we work with basically whoever is where the action is. So if it's OMG or W3C or the Europeans, you know, UN CFACT and all, or OMG or OAG, all these different organizations, we try and choose carefully and play a role where we think it's going to make the most difference in terms of getting some of these results. Many people think that NIST sets standards. In fact, we don't. There are no such thing as NIST standards. There are ANSI standards and there are OAG or OMG standards, but not NIST standards. Our role is really serving as technical experts in a lot of these committees and as a as a neutral measurement place. So we do play a role in support of other government agencies as well as a neutral place to go if they want a, if you like, a quote-unquote certifiable answer. As what's this measurement or what's our take on this? We try to play that role. Okay, enough of this preamble. Let me go to the next slide. So there are these two overarching issues that I made brief reference to at the beginning and what we need for standards. One is this need for rigor because, as you'll see in just a minute, you know, most standards, in fact, are just English prose and really nice and flexible but horrible when you're trying to be precise about what you mean by something. And therein lies a lot of problems because two different people, systems developers, let's say, will read the same words and come to quite different conclusions as to what the meaning is and go off and build their systems according to their interpretations, and then, lo and behold, these two systems don't interoperate. So we need to really get more precise about what we're talking about. And secondly, the reason we need to, I think that formal logic, formal ontological approaches obviously give us that. In fact, you know, when, way back when we were at the beginning of one project, the PSL project, that's the question we asked. How can we do our level best at nailing down these definitions of terms? And lucky for us, there happened to be a few philosophers and linguists and things in the room. They said, well, basically, you know, the philosophical community's been talking about precise definitions of terms for several, quite a few centuries, in fact, and that's what formal logic is all about, and if you really are serious about this, you should be using formal logic to define your standards. So that was a sort of an eye-opener for a lot of us, and that's exactly where we headed with this standard called the process specification language, which is indeed represented in Kip's statement, first order logic. Now, the other driver for us moving toward formal approaches is that we believe that we cannot anymore depend upon communities of people spending months, if not years, together in rooms and committees manually handcrafting interface standards, because we're in this combinatorial growth time where the number of interfaces is, you know, just going crazy. It's getting even more geometric in the sense that the bubbles you see on this slide, each one of those little circles is supposed to represent a whole supply chain in a given industry sector. And, of course, more and more these days, with even more outsourcing, these industry sectors themselves are trying to do more and more sort of internet-enabled business with each other. And that's a big problem because it was all very well when the automotive industry, say, had their definitions of designs and everything. Suddenly they're doing business with the chemical industry, and they have their own terminology set and even XML markup sets on how they think information should be represented, and they're quite different. And now these two very different contexts are trying to talk to each other. Big problem, because there's a lot of unspoken assumptions flying back and forth. And again, that's where we need to depend upon the rigor to nail down these things, but also we need to start automating how these interfaces get defined and exercised. And that's, in fact, the premise of another project I'll talk about toward the end of this talk. So a very ambitious project. So let me move on. Here's an example of what I'm talking about in terms of this rigor idea. The next slide, slide number 7. The first paragraph there, you can see, is just a straight cut and paste from an ISO standard that happens to be talking about the notion of time. And that's how it talks about it. You go in there and you read this text and you sort of build this model inside your head as to what really is being meant there. It's flexible, but not real, you know, pretty ambiguous. Okay, the next step in the, if you like, the evolution of a lot of normative information standards starts to look like data models. And this is actually an excerpt from a standard we spent a good decade on, which is the STEP standard for product data, handling design information, if you like, for CAD systems. And, you know, you can think of this as, you know, it could be C++. It's actually a language called Express. It could be UML, in fact. But it's really not, it's sort of become more UML-like over time. It does have things like constraints you can represent in it. But it started off essentially as a data modeling language. And that was pretty good as far as at least it gave us a big leg up. This Express standard, this STEP standard, has tens of thousands of entities defined in it. And we realized as a community very early on there was no way we were going to be hand-coding this stuff. And the nice thing about having a standard, the official normative standard, being in some kind of a compilable language, is that you can just hand it to a tool, you know, some kind of compiler, and next thing you know, you've got your database schema built. And when it evolves, then you can just, you know, plug it in and it'll get the new definition. Much better than natural language text for automating at least the management of the standard. But, of course, the big missing piece there still is that you have this, say, entity called product context. And what the heck is that supposed to mean? Well, it's a structure, and it's got the subtype of a couple of other things, and it's got this one slot called label, well, it's actually discipline type. But, you know, you're left then to go back to the informative part of the standard to figure out, and again, natural language text, build an idea of what this thing is supposed to be. So finally, now we're experimenting on the third paragraph there with what we're calling semantic model standards, and that's the PSL, the process specification language standard, which, by the way, just passed its final ballot, so it's going to be an international standard in a few months, at least the first part of it. It's a bunch of GIF statements, basically, and obviously gives you not only the ability to compile it and populate databases, but also to use it to reason with and to do all the good things you can do when you have something represented in first-order logic. Incidentally, one of the ISO rules is you can't make reference to anything else that's not an ISO standard, and KIF itself wasn't. So good old Michael Gruninger in my division agreed to be the editor for making KIF an ISO standard as well, so that's now going through the standardization process. All these years, people have been using KIF, and it really never was a standard. But so that's all been happening. So this is kind of what's led us toward using and treating formal logic systems for our bread and butter, which is working with normative standards in the international arena.
Steve?
Yeah.
You want to take questions?
Sure, absolutely.
Do you know what the status of the KIF effort is? Because I was involved in that, and then it seemed to just sort of devolve into a certain amount of rancor.
Well, I don't know the actual current status right now. I do know from Michael that there was a, you probably are familiar with this, there was kind of a tension between those who wanted to say, let's just nail down what we've got, call it an ISO standard, and those who said, hey, now that we're going to be standardizing, let's go ahead and recognize the things that are the limitations and put in all this other functionality.
Right.
And Michael was, especially because he needed it for the PSL, he said, look, why don't we hold off on some of the new and improved features, get this one standardized, and then we can talk about, you know, another subsequent standard for the newer functionality. I believe, my understanding is, that's the direction it's going, and maybe it seemed to go offline a little bit because the mechanics of actually standardizing what we pretty much had in place is underway. It's actually, you can actually search on the ISO website to find out exactly what the status is, or I'd be happy to ask Michael when we're done here, and I can put it on the wiki page if you like to find out.
You know what the ISO number is for KIF?
I don't offhand. No. Probably, if you know, try Google KIF and ISO and see what you get, because it probably will pop up.
So is this ISO 18629-11 the designation for PSL core?
That's for the PSL core, right. The way ISO standards often work, the standards often have what are called parts with a capital P. And dash one is usually reserved for what's called the overview and general principles. It's kind of an introduction to the standard. And that's the one that just got approved as an international standard. Part 11 is the one that's the as it's called, the core. That's the basic axioms underlying the process model. And it's sort of an onion peel kind of a model of a standard in the sense that these are the concepts that are shared by, as far as we're concerned, you know, every notion of process. And then around it, are you going to have then different add-ons, which are things like, well, what if you want to deal with, you know, stochastic processes, or what if you want to deal with intent, or various other aspects of process? Those would all be layers, higher part numbers on top of this 18629. So yeah, the core is the essence of it. And by the way, let's see. Not on this slide, but a couple of slides coming up is the link to the PSL web pages here at NIST, which take you through in excruciating detail all the axioms, all the formal code, and it's all free, you know, available public domain work. So you're encouraged to, you know, take a look if you're interested in exploring that more. But Michael's done some, what's to me, very impressive work. I'm by no means a logician. And he's ensured that these ontologies that make up these various pieces of the PSL standard have all the right properties of axiomatizability and the inverse of that. I always forget. Anyway, all the right kind of properties you would want a good ontology to have, certainly consistency and all. But he's written a few papers which do the theoretical proofs of these ontologies as ontology sets to demonstrate that those properties are indeed shared by the standards. Yeah.
Has he actually tested it with a theorem prover for contradiction?
I believe so. Yeah, in fact, I think that was a pretty early thing he did.
Oh, okay. You don't happen to know which prover offhand, do you?
I do not. I have to refer you to Michael on that one.
Okay, I'll check with him.
And in fact, let me, I should be making a note of all these links I'll probably put on the wiki page afterwards, but we have a publications list out of our division, which is searchable, and you can search for Gruninger, and you'll get all of his publications all about the PSL, as well as on the PSL webpage itself, the homepage, which I can tell you verbally is www.nist.gov/PSL. And that also links to all the publications related to PSL, including the theoretical proofs and also the work that was gone on in there. So I think
what we need even more is to have Mike be part of this team.
Yeah. Well, he is definitely the source when we have to resolve some issues of semantics. He's usually the one we go to in our team. Okay, next slide. I want to tell you a little bit about the sort of the high-level view again of how I have set the strategic course of this division. In a way, I'm repeating a little bit of what I said in the sense that standards often were either off the chart on this chart now. I've got one bubble showing the lower left corner, either natural language text or at least common models of data. And what I would put in that bubble category is XML markup suites, okay, markup sets. I categorize those as models of data, even though, of course, many people run around trying to claim that XML sets, you know, capture the semantics of something. I would dispute that, as I think most of you would as well. But nevertheless, on this sort of evolutionary path, if you go to the next bubble up, is where we're talking about, again, standards as represented by explicit formal semantics, with PSL being the first example coming out of our division, where we have done that, you know, through the formal ISO process. So the official standard is, in fact, the bunch of the KIF statements, and all the rest of the standard is simply informal. obviously the rigor we're looking for, at least a lot of the rigor. But it also starts to allow a few other capabilities. And the third bullet up, the bubble up, rather, is that obviously once a system has an ontology inside it, it has the ability to start describing at least the data it's manipulating in a form that another system can understand. And so that when a scheduling system is sending some internet message off to a dispatch system, and the dispatch system is saying, well, what's the scheduled delivery date? And the scheduling system says, well, let's see, what do you mean by delivery date? And now the dispatch system can actually send a definition of what it means by delivery date, because it's got this whole ontological definition. And ideally, what we think, it's got all the way down to an fully axiomatically described definition of what it means by delivery date, which is kind of the philosophy underneath PSL. So then, okay, that gets you part of the way. Now, of course, the receiving system has to then figure out, okay, you've given me this thing, and I've got my own ontology and ontological definition. How do I compare these two? And that's where some of the semantic distance issues come up, because I don't think that's a solved problem at this point. How do you compare two concepts out of two different ontologies to know, A, are they equal, which they generally won't be, and B, how far away are they from each other? So that's that whole semantic distance thing. But our holy grail anyway, and this is to address our other driving force of the labor intensiveness of standards committees, is to get to the fourth bubble on this chart, self-integrating systems. And that's clearly, in a pure sense, unattainable, because it would require human cognition, capabilities on the part of an automated system. But certainly we believe that a lot of the low-hanging fruit is achievable in terms of automating some of the easier, either context where the context is fairly finite, and some of the simpler concepts. So the analogy I often draw, which is a trivially easy compared to this problem, is that of today's fax machines, which basically there are about a half a dozen different fax protocols kicking around, and when you send a fax, you don't actually know the vintage of the fax machine is receiving this thing you're sending. And what happens is when you dial that other fax machine, these two machines enter a little negotiation with each other, sort of doing a most powerful to least powerful test. One of them will send the latest protocol, fancy dancy, great compression routine protocol, to the other one. Sort of a handshake, and the other one sits there mute because it has no idea what the thing is talking about. And so after a small amount of time, the sophisticated machine will try a not quite so fancy protocol and keeps going down the ladder until it gets something that, it gets a response out of this other thing. So you say, okay, great, this is a really stupid fax machine. I'll use the stupid protocol, and then off they go and they communicate. Okay, so that's obviously in an environment where there are only maybe six possible answers, which protocol to use. But it's a plug-and-play kind of philosophy that, Windows or whatever, the negotiation takes place, again, with a finite set of possibilities on scan rate for your monitor or whatever. So now expand that to a huge extreme where we're talking about now all of human knowledge, and you're just traversing through and trying to figure out what is this other system talking about. And then how should we start dynamically constructing an interface, essentially, to send information? That's obviously not that general in practice. If a CAD system is trying to send geometry to another CAD system, it could start saying, well, how do you represent an edge or a vertex on this solid model? And those kinds of problems are probably solvable for most of the time. So that is indeed an area we are looking into in one of our other projects, which I'll get to at the end of this talk. By the way, when am I supposed to finish this talk, Peter?
The call is reserved until 12 got another 40 minutes or so.
Okay. I probably won't take that long. So.
Right. But
okay.
Leave us some time for questions.
That's right. All right. So I'll keep moving right along here. Next slide. This slide is basically just a sort of a, if you like, a complexity or sophistication line where Conrad Bach, who also works in my division, was laying out from his view sort of how things are evolving in terms of capabilities of expressiveness, where, you know, you see XML there kind of in the middle, and obviously all the Daml oil and the OWL and things are heading out toward the right, and finally you get out to the instance-oriented languages like first-order logic and TSL out there, where indeed the distinction I know that Conrad has made to us in our own internal seminars is where first-order logic obviously allows you to distinguish between the class behavior and the instance behavior, you know, straightforwardly, whereas some of these other languages, sometimes those concepts get a little muddled together, and you don't know whether you're talking about relationships between the class or the instance.
So, Steve, just one quick comment.
Yeah.
It seems like one way to clarify this slide a little bit would be that, you know, you have first-order logic standards like TIFF, but TFL isn't a language. It's content written in a language.
True. That's right. You're absolutely right. Now, in depending on what your perspective is when you're thinking of it, a manufacturing guy is saying, well, TSL is a language for me because I can describe process plans and I can describe schedules in it. You know, I can put together constructs which constitute a plan. So, but you're right. From a fundamental perspective, it is not a language, and certainly not in the same way that first-order logic or KIF. Well, that KIF is a language. I agree with you. And in fact, in a way, we've often talked about whether we should have called it process specification language in the first place. But from the user's perspective, it, a lot of people sort of think of it that way. But anyway, you're right. That's a good point. Let me move on to the next slide here. So that's just an introductory high-level identification of the process specification language. It had its roots in our desire to actually integrate some commercial systems. These happen to be, as you see, process planners, schedulers, process modelers. We wanted to keep our feet on the ground in the sense of making sure this was actually useful for doing integration between these systems. And we have in the past demonstrated real data flowing between these real commercial systems, aided by essentially an ontological mapping to TSL, driving the syntactic translations which ultimately occur between one system and the next. And the fidelity of the concepts was very good when you have to submit to the rigorous definitions that TSL insists upon to map those concepts across.
Steve, question?
Yeah.
It's Adrian Walker. Steve, if I'm looking at this slide and I'm saying, gee, it's doing great stuff, do I, as an engineer, have to know PSL in order to see what it's doing?
In order to see what it's doing. Well, okay, let me interpret your question in a couple of ways. If you would ask, do I have to know PSL in order to use it to map between one system and another, the answer is no, you don't. To understand how it works, well, yeah, you probably do. But we're actually trying very hard to insulate your average software developer from having to be any kind of expert in first-order logic, to keep them from having to do that. And we're approaching that a couple of ways. One is a tool which still has a ways to go, but it's a tool that Michael and some collaborators have built called the 20 Questions Tool. And that's actually described on the webpage for PSL. Where is that web link? I thought I had it on there, but anyway. What it basically does is it splits up, if if you like, well, it's not in 20 anymore. Actually, it's more like 44 questions. So basically, it divides the semantic space that PSL covers into about 44 orthogonal subspaces. And each question then is asked, which makes you choose a unique answer as to how you're resolving a particular aspect, one of these orthogonal dimensions, how you think of it. I'm probably not coming across very clearly, but let's say the question was, for example, do you have the notion in your system of sequence, let's say, and you either do or you don't. Some systems may not. They may just have a collection of things that have to happen, but there's no notion of sequencing or orderedness. So you answer that question, yes or no, or sometimes there are multiple answers, not just two. And in the process of that, what you're doing is you're resolving some very specific issues down in the logic. And when you finish using this tool, which you're basically being asked these questions and you're just answering them in, radio buttons, if you like, what it'll spit out at you is a KIF characterization of the semantic notions that you have just described in your system. And the whole point of that tool... profiles of two different systems against each other, feed them to another tool, which we have, and it'll tell you straight off which concepts are you going to be able to transfer from one system to another and which ones are you not going to be able to transfer because they don't exist in the other system. So it gives you a great insight at a purely semantic level of what your success rate is going to be on interoperability between these two systems. It doesn't...
Is this tool available outside of NIST?
The 20 questions tool is available. It's on our webpage. In fact, you can run it from the webpage.
What's it called? 20
www.mel.nist.gov/psl/20questions.
220 or 220?
Yeah, actually, you can navigate to it from just the PSL homepage.
Okay.
It's one of the links right there.
Okay.
And Steve, the second tool that you mentioned?
The second tool is not yet out there. It's still being... I've seen it in ugly demo mode internally. And it, basically it's just two text things in, the KIF statements, and it gives a textual listing out. So we're trying to make it a little... harden it up a little bit and generalize it and write it up. So it's not really available yet, but... it's coming.
And that's quite exciting because it almost sounds as though you could extract some kind of semantic distance from, the things that don't match.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't really address that. It does sort of give you a handle on the semantic overlap of two systems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But on an individual concept basis, it can't really quantify semantic distance.
Okay.
But anyway, it's definitely... Well, first of all, I've really seen a compelling demonstration that it's not dealing with syntax at all. It's purely dealing with the semantic concepts, and that's kind of exciting. But so anyway, that's an example of kinds of things we're hoping are going to be possible once we have a strong foundation, a semantic foundation to build on. Now. Various people. I know, Adam, you're pretty familiar with PSL. I'm not suggesting that we do what we've done with PSL for all of human knowledge, because this is a labor of love. I mean, this has taken a long time. It's a very, constrained context of process. There are explicit assumptions even there. For example, we discovered a couple of years in that, we're talking about processes like schedules and plans and things that happen on a factory floor, and we had the notion, we're talking about the occurrence time, let's say, of an event as essentially being synchronous everywhere, and know, suddenly a network guy was talking to us. And, of course, that's not at all true when you're talking about electricity flowing wires. And we it made us realize, well, of course, yes, we are talking about things in a sort of the human scale of things. We're not talking about the speed of light, and we're not talking about electricity when we talk about events and times of events. And that was just one more example where we had just assumed that, and we hadn't really thought about all the assumptions, you know, classic frame problem kind of situation.
Question, how many concepts are in TSL now, would you say, roughly?
Well,
what are they?
Well, there are only on the order of a half a dozen axioms at the very base of TSL. And then everything else is just definitions using KIF. So it's not like a data model where you define entities. It's just definitions on definitions. But I guess the short answer is, how many definitions are there? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I guess the question I'm trying to get at is, what you said it took a long time, and I'm wondering what the rate limiting factor is.
Well, it takes, it would be, let's see, one difficulty is, if you did this as a committee, in other words, one rate limiting thing is obviously just the number of heads thinking about it.
Right.
As soon as you get beyond one sort of master designer, then you're going to open up the door to inconsistencies right away. You
that's
know?
What I'm really worrying about.
That's right.
How many different people had input?
Well, a lot of people had input. Michael was really the master editor of BSL. He essentially wrote the final compilation of the stuff that went into the ISO committees and stuff. There was a lot of input and a lot of debates and stuff. Certainly, I know that, like, Chris Menzel down in Texas, and in the early days we had, let's see, well, Austin Tate was involved, and Jintae Lee in Hawaii, and Demetrius Karitsis in Switzerland. I mean, actually, I should say, I'm reeling off some of these names. These were all names of people who were involved in an earlier DARPA-funded project called PIF, Process Interchange Format, which Bob Netches was funding when he was a DARPA program manager.
Tate did the business ontology. Was it Tove?
Yeah, Tove. This came out of the Tove stuff. Michael Groninger was at University of Toronto with doing Tove up there, and Innova, I guess it was. And then he came to NIST. About the time when Mark Fox closed down his lab in Toronto, where Michael Groninger was working, so he's been at NIST here ever since. But yeah, that's the sort of the ancestry of some of this. It turns out we had started working on TSL in parallel, separately from the PIF people, and but we found each other pretty quickly. And PIF version 2. The core axioms and all were identical to PSL version 1 core axioms.
I've seen it described as PIF/PSL.
Yeah, that's when we were merging. So they ultimately merged, and PSL has taken the ball and run with it, building on top of what.
Okay, thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Okay, so this next slide is, there's finally my link there to the PSL webpage. It's just demonstrating to some people, and I think that would be belaboring the point to you guys, that, you know, transferring information from one system to another is greatly strengthened if you don't just focus on the syntactic mappings, but you actually go and are driven by the ontological mappings in some interlingua, which, and PSL was designed to be essentially that interlingua. It was never designed originally to be a native representation for process, although some people are now talking about maybe trying that out. It was designed to be the neutral interlingua when you're going from one system to another. So that's, I think I'll just move on that one. Now, the other major effort I wanted to spend a little time describing is this other project called AMIS, Automated Methods for Integrating Systems. And this is the project where we are taking shot at seeing how much of a systems integration activity can we actually automate, our holy grail thing. What you see on the top half of the slide, VNC, that's all you see, is a typical tool A talking to some other tool B, and each one has an advertised API, probably sits on top of some middleware, and you essentially map or translate from message one, A1 and A into B, whatever, B2 and B. So you're just doing syntactic mappings back and forth. The AMIS architecture, if you like, is the rest of the slide, which I'm now bringing up, which basically says, okay, what really is going on, of course, is you must identify what we're calling the interaction model, which is essentially the intersection of the ontologies of A and B in the context of whatever it is you're trying to achieve. So for a given interaction, if you're just doing, say, a request for quote from A to B, you know, it's what concepts are embedded within that request for quote. That's constituting the interaction model. And then the shared business entity model has to do with the actual data that's flying back and forth. You know, what are we talking about? Prices, you know, all those definitions and things. And essentially, what we're going to try and do with, you know, the easiest problem first is you feed all that in. So first of all, you have to map then from any system into this interaction ontology. And then you have to, once you have those mappings taking place, and in the easiest sense that would be, okay, this concept in B is exactly equal to this concept in the interaction ontology. That'd be the easiest case to do. And driven by those mappings, then you feed that back up into what we're calling this connector transform tool, which, first of all, rides on top of the appropriate middleware of either system and spits out the appropriate syntax up at the syntactic level for the information to flow back and forth. So it's basically an ontologically driven machine translation system. So that's kind of the top-level view of what AMIS is all about. It, as far as where we are with that, that was the one link, Peter, I was going to put up on the, there we are, actually, the next slide, which somebody very kindly advanced. There's a link to a document there, a PDF file. That was the result of the first year of activities on this AMIS project, which basically said, first, before we can really take a systematic approach to this, we've got to really characterize cleanly what system integration involves, and only then can we start to decide how are we going to tackle it, how can we construct an architecture that makes sense, and which pieces of this systems integration problem are we going to tackle first. And that's a very thought-provoking paper, and ultimately I would, you know, urge to take a look. It's not specifically about ontologies. In fact, it's much more just about systems integration. The one part that was kind of an eye-opener to me, even though I've been in the systems integration business for a while, was what I've summarized on the half a dozen slides here, and I'm not going to go them in great detail, but the very next slide you can see, it goes through, and I think there are about 20-odd different categories of integration problems that really need to be thought of and considered and resolved when you're integrating one system with another. And when you start going through these, you realize that a lot of these aren't thought of. And the easy ones are things like, well, obviously you have to map the data models, you know, or the concepts, if you want to be semantic about it. But when you start thinking about, okay, well, how do they encode the data, that's the syntactic conflict that might occur. You know, as it says there, one system uses ASENT.1, which is an encoding scheme, and another one might use XML, so you've got to deal with that. The control conflict is a little more subtle, where you might have two clients talking to each other, and each one's expecting the other one to be a server. And that's no good, obviously. You know, either they're both trying to control the other, or they're both sitting around waiting for someone to tell them what to do. On the next slide, there are things like one's a real-time system and the other one isn't. How do you deal with that mismatch in terms of, if you like, you know, impedance matching? Or the data consistency kind of idea where there are assumptions made about the currency of the data from one side or the other of an interface, and you get, you know, well, things like what we call the ships passing in the night problem, you know, in terms of inconsistent data because of the assumptions being made about updates or locks on the transactions themselves. Next slide goes through now some of the semantic issues, whether they are scoping issues or just absence of concepts, like this, you know, one just simply doesn't have the notion of version. These are the kind of things that would be popping out of that other tool I was talking about earlier as well. I'd just say, well, sorry, absence concept, you know, out of luck. Let me go to the next slide. We got interpretation conflicts, and again, you know, the simple ones would be things like, you didn't tell me the units, I'm assuming meters, and in fact this other guy was assuming feet or something. And then, yeah, referential conflicts in terms of how are you identifying a thing in one system. And often, of course, these are joint keys or something. They're not just a single identifier. And yet your joint keys may be quite different from other equally valid joint keys, even for the same object. So you've got to reconcile that. Where am I now? Functional issues. Terms of, who's responsible for updating what information. And again, I'm zooming through these rather quickly because these are all somewhat tangential to the issues of semantics and ontologies, but very important to the issue of what one of the big advantages of using semantics and ontologies is in terms of integrating systems with each other. So even if we solve the ontology problem, there's still plenty of other problems around which can derail a systems integration activity, even if you completely understand each other's data. So, and in fact, I should just say, parenthetically, that we are typically not trying to solve all these problems in our own work. We are somewhat scoping ourselves to data integration problems at present. We've gotten a little bit into the notions of choreography of protocols, checking on order of arrival of things, and sequencing of communications, which gets a little bit beyond the data. And that's primarily driven from some of our current collaborators in the business-to-business world, where obviously the sequences of these things is also very important to them. So I won't read through some of these. You're welcome, of course, to read them at your leisure. Down on the intention, let's see, what was that one? The note feature, oh yeah, that's just basically abuse of fields, which occurs a lot in databases, where, you know, the other field and all kinds of stuff is thrown in there, which is obviously a challenge when you're trying to integrate these things, especially when you're automating the integration. And then, yeah, the embedded versus non-embedded system, you know, this thing was never built to be embedded inside another system. They expected to have a, you know, a GUI of some sort. And how are you going to do with that? In fact, we actually have some tools which help with that. But as far as essentially, well, there's a language called Expect, which we've, one of my staff built many years ago now, which is, comes out as part of Linux in many releases, which is essentially a interaction scripting tool, which can be used precisely for that, to allow systems which were intended to be used with humans to be then scripted in a very flexible way. Anyway, let's see. Qualitative, then we get into the more arm-waving kinds of issues you still have to think about, like security and timeliness and reliability. And finally, I think the last one had to do with logistical issues. What about failure, which, of course, can launch you into an entire project as big as whatever you were working on. How do you deal with recovery from failure? In my own distant past, when I was working on control and distributed control architectures, it was one problem which was actually fairly easy to design protocols and architectures in an error-free environment. And then we spent three times as long handling, oh, but what about the errors, you know, and how do you recover? Especially in a distributed environment, that's no trivial task. You find yourself in situations where no part of the system knows exactly what another part of the system was doing in its entirety before it vaporized. So you're stuck. But so finally, that's my summary slide then, is that the whole systems integration problem, which is the space we're working in, is obviously a very hard problem, which we're just trying to whittle away little pieces of. It is, from a business perspective, getting to be more and more expensive and more of a thorn in people's sides. We are big advocates here of trying to use as rigorous of techniques as possible in the standards world to try and nail down the definitions of standards themselves. And it's for that reason that we are big advocates of the semantic approach, which of course is always a hard sell to people who aren't familiar with what this is all about. And I lose this battle frequently when pitching for funding and things. But anyway, my final point is that as much as, you know, Tim Berners-Lee is credited with, and rightly so, with, you know, a lot of the impact of the World Wide Web, I would submit, as he also implies in his books, that that's going to be dwarfed by the effect it's going to have in the business community when suddenly this information is comprehensible and computable, as opposed to just meaningful to people. Because, you know, today, most of that stuff out there is complete nonsense to the computers that are shipping it around the web. And until we start actually describing it, not in XML, but actually in ontological terms, then computers can actually start doing useful stuff with it. I mean, I'm not the only one obviously saying this, and I think we're all probably the ones saying this. But I think the impact on businesses is going to be phenomenal, and so we need to be, you know, ready for those impacts, I think. So that's a quick sketch, or not so quick sketch, of our take on use of semantics and ontologies from a standards perspective. So I will entertain any questions.
Wonderful. Great presentation, Steve. Peter Yim here. I have a couple of questions, actually. I mean, since we talked a little bit earlier about PSL and KIF, and since our first project, which is the UPL ontology project that this community is embarking on,
right,
is grounding its work on Adam Suzumo. So
right.
Maybe I have a question for both of you. What is the union or intersection of PSL and Sumo, and where can we see some sort of convergence that works?
You want to take a shot at that, Adam, first?
Sure. I think it's a great question. So, I mean, I also wanted to give you my thanks, Steve, for the presentation. It's just outstanding. I mean, I feel like if I could have, I would be happy giving all the same slides, because I agree with all the points that you've made.
Oh, good.
You've improved communicating in several ways on the ways that I normally make some of those points. So maybe I want to talk with you about even reusing a slide or two of yours.
By right. All means. Public domain, paid for by taxpayer.
Great. you know, the only, and let me just give sort of a larger answer to Peter's more focused question. Because, you know, the only concern or criticism that I've had about PSL is something that you alluded to earlier, which is just that the scope is just manufacturing processes. And, in fact, that PSL as a standard could have far greater impact if it were part of a constellation of integrated ontologies. And that's really what I'm trying to do with Sumo, which is address, you know, ultimately, it's an egotistical goal, address everything.
Yeah.
And address everything incrementally, starting at a very general level and then gradually getting more and more specific and getting more and more people involved in creating specific ontologies.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, there is a very direct semantic correspondence between certainly what's covered in PSL Core is also covered semantically, although in a slightly different axiomatic way, in Sumo itself. And so it would be absolutely natural to integrate the two.
I agree that they are certainly not incompatible at all. And so that would just be a question of, yeah, holding them up to each other and seeing how they fit. Let me address another aspect, though, which is a sort of a strategic decision, I guess, or looking into the future. And this is actually what's sort of also underlying why we headed in the direction of this AMOS project of trying to automate integration. I'm still very much on the fence myself about the following question. Is it going to be possible for us to have a unifying ontology which we can all subscribe to for essentially most of our activities and things, which I would say is sort of the underlying belief of Sumo, right? That we have this sort of this shared notion of definitions, at least at some thickness of layer there.
Right. There may be other choices. There are other ways that would be equally valid that one could do it, but that Sumo picks a way that we believe is suitable.
Right. Now, and I guess the question in my mind is, given that there are, in fact, of course, multiple ways of laying out your view of definitions and ontology, can we, well, my presumption, let me put it in a sort of a debate form here, and then you can throw rocks at it. But my position is that, in fact, we will probably never succeed in getting everyone or even most people to buy into a single model. And if that's true, then we're always going to be cursed with the fact that we're going to have all these essentially incompatible, possibly, usually, incompatible definitions of terms in the world. And in fact, the assumption going into AMOS was that in the extreme, every system that you're trying to integrate with any other system is going to have a different and in some ways incompatible ontology embedded within it. So that you're always going to face, generally, the issue of system A and system B are going to have different ontologies which are to some extent going to be incompatible. And the challenge is to find out how much is shareable between those two ontologies. And that in fact, just because people are difficult, we're never going to be able to get everyone to buy into any one unifying ontology. Now, I say that in a very sort of a direct way. I don't entirely believe even what I'm saying myself.
I have an opinion on that.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I believe what you say about needing some method of conversion is probably going to be true for the immediate future. I feel strongly that it will happen, and I don't know how long it will take, but it will happen, that there will be one widely usable standardized upper ontology which people use when they want to achieve interoperability with other systems. Now, of course, locally, someone who has the slightest bit of interest in talking with other systems may decide to use something simpler for their own purposes. But if you want to talk, I think there will be one. That is,
well, it's possible. I think that obviously the jury's out. I think the thing that people are really good at, of course, is holding multiple contradictory notions in their heads at the same time. And
well, but they do that because they have different contexts.
Exactly.
You can represent. That's what I'm saying is you can have a number ontology which represents context and therefore allows for
multiple
that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that would clearly be one of the necessary ingredients is to be able to switch contexts. So you're saying now that the upper ontology would be a multiple context kind of a
well, in the layer. Ontology I'll put up just today, for example, we're working on things. In the ontology I put up, I have context as one of the top level concepts. You have physical, you have abstract, you have context. It's different from everything else.
Yeah,
and it has a lot of different components to it.
Uh-huh.
And it's just people are embedded in context every time they try to interpret anything they say.
That's right.
And an autonomous system must also have that as being a very prominent, in my opinion,
right. context as being a very prominent element in whatever anything it attempts to interpret.
Yep, I agree with that, and it's for that reason that I feel that we're going to try and see if we can develop some technology which allows one to make no assumptions between any two systems, and then either through a discovery process or a negotiation process, arrive at an understanding of what shared concepts are there between the two systems.
Let me just say one last thing, and I'll be assertive in this case.
I think
it's going to be a lot tougher to develop a interpreter that will try to reconcile concepts in different independently built ontologies than it would be to get agreement on a top-level ontology that everybody will use as a fundamental thing for defining everything.
That is the key question. In fact, of course, one of those tasks is technologically very hard, and the other task is sort of humanly very hard. And the question is, which turns out to be tougher, is the technology or getting the people to agree? And I don't know the answer to that one. And you're right, we've sort of, in that sense, we are tackling the two different, they're complementary though. I don't think either one precludes the other, and if we make progress on both, that's great.
I think for the immediate future, I know other people too have been concerned with ontology mapping and mapping and merging of ontologies, and that probably will continue for a while because we don't have agreements. As time as we do, people will still do that work.
And I should also add that, when I was talking about that industrially, accessible work we're doing, I'm completely in the camp that in any given industrial context where, some well-defined community is trying to just get interoperability, heck, I'm even encouraging them to just stick with XML, because often as not, all of their mental models, they're all sharing the same semantics, in fact. So they all think of the same thing when they see a given word.
Right.
And they don't need to get into all this, heavy-duty semantics anyway.
Right.
And XML worked great. And
until they have to share with somebody else.
Well, that's exactly the point of my multiple industry sector chart there.
Precisely on point. I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. That was a very, very good representation.
Yeah, as soon as you exchange content. And we even had it way back when we were doing the STEP standard. We started off, we were doing exchange of CAD models, design models, between CAD systems.
Right.
And that was fine. We were doing great until someone wanted to exchange that CAD model with a process planning system, which had a manufacturing perspective.
Mike Ushold had mentioned to me that was one of the problems he had with Boeing, that there were more than one CAD vendor, and then when you try to relate more than one CAD vendor,
that's true.
CAD vendor. So I thought he said there's a lot more. You seem to say it's not so difficult.
Well, it's all a question of scale. Even the CAD still took a decade. We would submit. And in fact, Boeing's been very active in the STEP community, and in fact is a big promoter of the use of STEP, even though they're still using CATIA in-house right now. We are very much arm-in-arm with each other, Boeing and NIST, in terms of moving toward open systems approaches like STEP. But maybe I should put it this way. As difficult as it was to define a standard just to get CAD-to-CAD interoperability, the problem became an order of magnitude harder as soon as you wanted to try and transfer it to a different content.
Right, okay.
So, yeah.
So, Steve, just one quick response to the issue of sort of scope of ontology. My feeling is that the marketplace will give us a solution that is somewhere in between the extremes of everybody using one ontology and everybody using different ontologies.
Uh-huh.
There's certainly going to be network effects that are going to encourage people to come together to varying degrees.
That's right.
Depending upon how much they have to communicate with one another.
Yeah.
There are powerful business effects there.
That's right.
Encourage people to be able to share. And then I guess... apart from sort of predicting what the market's going to do, there's also an issue of what can we do as standards interests bodies to try to make commerce easier for everyone.
Right.
There I think we have a case of we can at least try to bring more and more ontologies together.
Right.
There's a certain camp in the ontology community that says we can't get complete agreement, therefore we're not going to try to get any agreement. And I think that's a sort of damaging philosophical approach, so that even if we may not be able to get 100% agreement between a sort of more focused ontology like PSL and a broader ontology like SUMO, it at least is in everybody's interest for us to try to bring them into coherent state.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And of course, there's another big barrier, which is just to get the standards community to accept the notion of ontology in the first place is by no means solved. I mean, I couldn't even use the words ontology or semantics a few years ago because industry people would just run out of the room screaming. Now, I think some people are at least, they're turning slightly pale, but at least they're staying in the room when you say those kinds of words. But, you know, most of industry is far away from being ready to start using this kind of technology, I think. So, I mean, that's still very much a barrier.
That's that old quote, when somebody says ontology, I reach for my gun.
Just a good point, Adam. And before Adam, that was Pat, right?
Yeah.
So, please identify yourself. Everybody sounds almost alike. Open the phone. Actually, my Peter Yim here. My second question was, I mean, with the mainly RDF approach that is hitting the semantic web, what is NIST's position?
I mean,
I can almost hear what you say. I mean, probably quite along the line of what Guarino or maybe Adam Pease or Mike Greninger would have those same positions, but what are you doing about it as a sort of standards body and steward of this country's standards?
Well, the steward of this country's standards, that's an interesting one, but let's see, I guess the short answer is that I think RDF is definitely on the right trajectory. It's adding a little bit more rigor, a little bit more expressiveness, you know, on top of what was there before, and I think OWL, you know, is taking things a little further. They haven't gone, you know, they still don't have the full axiomatic grounding, but again, I think it's going to be good enough for even more situations than XML was, you know, for other applications. So I think it's going in the right direction, and I think it will continue to get improved upon as the communities that use them run into an inability to express certain things or distinguish between certain situations. And again, I would then turn to like someone like Conrad Bach at my division, who was going on about the, he and Michael agree on this, Michael Groninger, the difficulty of when you're starting to distinguish between instance-level logical relationships and class-level logical relationships. I'm now just deferring to them when they say, you know, you come up short when you're using even something like OWL on that. And I'm definitely out of my league here, so I don't want to embarrass myself any further on that. But I'm a big fan of the more recent, you know, W3C kinds of representations coming out and stuff. I think that's the way to go, and we need to go there and even further as time goes on. I think people are not, you know, some of these things, I think people have to try them out and then discover the limitations and really feel them emotionally before they're going to buy into the next level. And in that sense, you know, HTML was rolled out in just the right way, and I think that's why it succeeded where SGML didn't. Even though SGML was far more powerful, it was too big a learning curve for people. So people used HTML version 1, which was pretty awful, couldn't do much of anything, but got people comfortable with it, and comfortable enough that they started feeling frustrated with what it couldn't do. And then that led on to the next thing, you know, which led on to XML and so on and so forth. So maybe it's just a question of getting a critical mass of people in the right place in terms of what they recognize they need, instead of just trying to convince them of the wisdom of going all the way to the end up front.
Yeah, we actually saw that in the DARPA DAML program, where the DAML language started out as being just a very few, you know, like a dozen terms with defined semantics added to RDF, and now it's evolved into something that's approaching first-order logic with OWL.
Right. It's not quite there, but it's definitely getting closer, right?
Right.
I agree.
Okay. I guess we're running close to running out of time, and if Steve, you could make a concluding remark. We all thank you for this wonderful presentation and exchange.
Such flattery. Well, I actually found this whole experience very interesting, actually, kind of fun. I'd love to sort of sit in on some of these future sessions. I think it's a really cost-effective way to interact with people. So I would love to have that opportunity. And, you know, we'll have to see where things are going, as far as I think we all share the same desires and, passion, that's a good word. So, you know, in terms of whether it's the UBL context, we can certainly talk about that and the ontological stuff in general. I mean, I think, you know, many of us, of course, bump into each other anyway in various places. So I think this is a great way for us to keep sort of a mind meld and sharing intelligence on what's happening and the progress. So you've got a supporter here.
I have one more question. The word has not yet been mentioned today, psych, and you have mentioned, or at least the question was raised, as to what extent PSL might integrate with Sumo. Do you know of anyone who has attempted actually to integrate PSL with Psych or Sumo?
Well, not with Psych. I mean, first of all, I guess we did, when Psych, supposedly that portion of Psych that was put in the public domain,
yes.
And I guess some of my people tried to take a look at that, but they had all kinds of difficulties with sort of handling that piece that was released and stuff. We have... well, I don't think, let's see, what has happened? Adam probably knows more than I, because I know that, like, David Flater has worked with you, Adam, right?
Right. He's got a version of Sumo and Loom.
Right.
The main problem you're going to have with Psych is they haven't released the axioms, so you don't know what any of the terms actually mean. So it wouldn't be really possible with the free version to do an integration with PSL.
Yeah, I think until... I mean, I don't think Doug Lennon's about to, you know, release the whole thing to the public domain, because he's got a business model going there. So I'm not sure what future there is, really, in that.
Okay, so I guess that's the important follow-up question I had, was were there any plans in your shop to try to use Psych for your work? And
no.
The answer is no.
That's right.
Okay.
There really are.
Good. Good. And we can proceed with it.
Yeah. I mean, and sort of philosophically, you know, we're definitely in the sort of open systems camp, obviously, and that's what we see in the future. You know, that's how standards work, really. So that's probably where we'll keep working and avoid some of the proprietary solutions.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. You have outstanding invitation to participate in.
Oh, great.
I would strongly encourage you to urge some of your staff to participate.
Well, I'll do that.
You know, right now we're concentrating initially on the question of business messages, you know, invoices, orders, and related things.
Right.
But of course, trying to get that right entails a lot of other stuff as well. And I don't know to what extent you're concerned with that in any of the work you're doing. I guess that's another question.
Well, actually, we are, and I actually have some questions about UBL to you guys as well. We are in the sense that, for example, we are doing a fair amount of work in a couple of different business contexts. One, which is kind of interesting, is the chemical industry, as personified by a consortium called CIDX, Chemical Industry Data Exchange, came to us because specifically they recognized they were doing more and more business with other industry sectors like the automotive sector, because they're supplying a lot of chemicals to the automotive sector. And both industry sectors had fairly entrenched XML suites and protocols established in their own supply chains. So they came to us and said, we are, you know, a little bit stuck here because neither of us can really afford to migrate. So what do we do, kind of thing? So we've been actually working on a sort of the standards convergence kind of idea of mapping between those very concepts, invoices, you know, requests for quotes, et cetera, between those two communities.
Do either of them have a formal ontology of any kind?
The CIDX people have, I believe, just a bunch of XML definitions.
Okay.
I don't think they have anything sort of anything like first order logic like, and I don't even think using OWL.
And the auto people?
The auto people actually don't have just a single answer anyway, so it's much more fragmented.
Okay.
Where I think a lot of the activity right now, and certainly where we're working with the auto people, is through the Open Applications Group, which is a consortium with a, I can't remember how many members now, but anyway, they have been a content level consortium. They've been working on what are called business object documents. Came out of the enterprise resource planning world, ERP. And they've been riding on top of various technologies. It doesn't really matter to them, which is good. I'm in that camp myself. So the BODs, these business object documents, are being mapped into various other forms. Anyway, I guess the point is that's probably what's most amenable right now to modeling ontologically is some of these BODs. And we've been toying with some of that sort of on an experimental basis in the context of things like there's a big project that's being coming out of General Motors right now hosted by the Automotive Industry Action Group called Inventory Visibility, where they're interested in being able to essentially traverse their suppliers' inventories so they know what their suppliers have on hand and vice versa. And in that context, we are trying out some of these semantic ideas.
Yeah, that's great. That's really important for just-in-time manufacturing.
Exactly.
Sure.
So what we're trying to do, and this is sort of the way we're sort of migrating some of the stuff we're learning when we're doing the sort of the basic research in the ontology approaches into our more applied testbed activities. Some of the testing activities will be more than just syntactic testing. They'll actually be content testing and choreography testing.
A follow-up, does any of these business object documents monthly with them, do they include things like orders and invoices?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
There are hundreds of business object documents.
Okay.
Pretty comprehensive.
Who was that second? Is that one of our groups?
That was Bill McCarthy. I'm sorry.
Bill, okay.
Sure,
sir.
Sorry.
Yeah, Bill, maybe as a follow-up, maybe if you could send us a pointer on what you know about that.
I would appreciate it. I was on the inventory and visibility interoperability project until I ran out of money to belong to AIAG. It's been 9 months since I've been to a meeting. But
Well, keep talking to us.